Wherever you are, we welcome you. Wherever you come from, we welcome you. Whomever you love, we welcome you. My name is Melissa Carvel-Zemer. It's my privilege to serve as the minister of this congregation. I'm joined in welcoming you this morning by Kathy Kearns, who's serving as our worship associate today, our director of religious education, Karen Lapidus, and our music director, Hal Walker.
I'm very pleased to introduce Sue Jeffers this morning. She is a local folk singer and political activist. So please give Sue a warm welcome. Thank you.
Next week, you're again invited to join us for worship at 9:30 and 11:15. I will be leading the service accompanied by worship associate Danny Beal. The title of my sermon is The Way Gratitude Wears. At the end of today's service, Kathy and I will be glad to greet you at the rear of the sanctuary. And once again, I bid you welcome. Vivian Sandlin is lighting our chalice this morning.
A. Powell Davies teaches us that courage is the conquest of fear, not the absence of it.
Later in the service, you'll hear a song by Susan Werner called Did Trouble Me that talks about how we feel at those times when we're struggling to live our values. So she begins the song by singing,
"When I close my eyes, I would not see, my Lord did trouble me.
When I close my eyes, so I would not see." How often do we close our eyes to things we just do not want to see? Maybe it is a child who's being bullied on the playground, or a coworker who's being berated by his or her boss. Or we try not to think about some things, like maybe that person at church who's not legally allowed to marry his or her partner, or the child who frequently hears, "No, we can't get that. No, we can't afford those lessons," all because the child was unlucky enough to be born into a family of limited financial means. If we open our eyes, we can see the need and the injustice that is all around us, those both big and small. But sometimes, even when we close our eyes, our feelings betray us. Susan Werner tells us,
"Did trouble me with a word or sign, with the ringing of the bell in the back of my mind. Did trouble me, did stir my soul, for to make me human, to make me whole."
To make me human, to make me whole. Is that what happens when we close our eyes? We feel less human, less whole? Today we explore some of these questions. When do we feel strongly, yet want to close our eyes to others' difficulties? What can help us to keep our eyes open? That is, how can we put our faith, our beliefs, into action? When are we willing to try to right a wrong, even when we might experience some consequences for doing so? Might it be so we can feel human, we can feel whole? Come, let us explore these questions together.
I offer you these words from Mangane Wale Sorote to lead us into a time of prayer and reflection and silence. Sorote is a South African poet, a member of the African National Congress. He played an important role in the development of Black identity, resistance, and revolt in his native country. After earning an MFA from Columbia University in 1979, Sorote lived in exile in Botswana for many years, where he was actively involved in the work of the ANC underground. He was able to return to South Africa in 1990 and was appointed the head of the ANC's Department of Arts and Culture. This poem comes from his collection, There Will Be a Better Time. Time has run out for those who ride on others. If the we is the most of us, and the most of us is the will to say no. When the most of us will create a better time, there will be a better time. When time has run out for liars, for those who take and take and take and take from others, take forever and keep taking for themselves alone. Take and take and take. Time has run out when we say no. No more. No more is not a word, but an act. Remember that, my friend. No more starts with learning to learn. Learn to carry the past like we do with dirty clothes. Carry them to the washing place and wash them. We carry the past to the present and wash it by learning what it means. When what it means becomes our action, because we have learned it, like you learn 2 + 2 = 4, so you can count 4 if you have 4 sweets. We use the past we learned like that. We say grandma and grandpa and pa and ma come from here. We are born here, and so we are here. Here is our land. We'll keep silence for a few moments together. Please hold in your hearts and minds this morning the family of Beth Schultes. Beth was a former member of this congregation who moved to California, and she died in this past week. We will share details of the funeral arrangements her family is making when they become available to us. And I invite you to join with me now in the spirit of prayer. And I'll tell you, I have a colleague who says that congregational prayer doesn't count unless you can hear a baby. So let the noises of the babies in our midst be woven into our prayer. Spirit of life and of love, Spirit of mystery and wonder, we gather this morning to rest for a moment, to pause on the forming edge of our lives, to reflect. We gather for a moment of reflection. This past week for us has been so full. We pause now to reflect upon our many blessings, to take time to give thanks for these gifts we have been given. And we pause now to reflect on the moments this past week when we have fallen short, the moments when we have been too quick to anger, too slow to forgive, too short on patience. We pause to consider these moments and to consider whether we are called to make amends to someone in our lives, or whether we are simply called to remember now, to remember our aspirations, our highest aspirations, to remember that we are connected one to the other and to everyone on this earth we share, to remember that our lives are bound up together, to remember how we want to live in this interdependent world. We pause now to remember the many blessings we have been given and to consider the moments which lie before us this day, hundreds of moments given to us for thanksgiving and praise and for living the kinds of lives we most want to live. May it be so, and amen.
When I left things stand that should not be, my alone did trouble me. When I held my head too high, too proud, my alone did trouble me. When I raised my voice too little, too loud, my alone did trouble me, it did trouble me with the word of a sign, with the ringing of the bell in the back of my mind. It did trouble me, it did stir my soul, for to make me human. When I slept too long or slept too deep, my alone did trouble me. Put a worrisome vision into my sleep, my alone did trouble me. When I held myself away and apart, my Lord did trouble me. And the tears of my brother didn't trouble my heart. And my Lord did trouble me. It did trouble me with the word of a sign, with the ringing of the bell in the back of my mind. Trouble me did stir my soul, to make me human, to make me whole. And of this I'm sure, of this I know, and my Lord will trouble me. Whatever I do, wherever I go, and my Lord will trouble me. In the whisper of the wind or the rhythm of a song, my Lord will trouble me. To keep me on the path where I belong, and my Lord will trouble me. Will trouble me with the word of a sign, with the ringing of a bell in the back of my mind. Did trouble me, did stir my soul, or to make me human, to make me whole.
Our reading this morning is from Robert Bly, and it's called Call and Answer. Tell me why it is we don't lift our voices these days and cry over what is happening. Have you noticed the plans are made for Iraq and the ice cap is melting? I say to myself, go on, cry. What's the sense of being an adult and having no voice? Cry out. See who will answer. This is call and answer. We will have to call especially loud to reach our angels, who are hard of hearing. They are hiding in the jugs of silence filled during our wars. Have we agreed to so many wars that we can't escape from silence? If we don't lift our voices, we allow others, who are ourselves, to rob the house. How come we've listened to the great criers, Neruda, Akhmatova, Thoreau, Frederick Douglass, and now we're silent as sparrows in the little bushes? Some masters say our life lasts only 7 days. Where are we in the week? Is it Thursday yet? Hurry, cry now. Soon, Sunday night will come.
Okay, so how many of you enjoy being on the receiving end of dissent? Very few of us, if any. Some of you will remember that a couple of years ago, I went to protest in Arizona, a hateful anti-immigrant law, the first in a string of hateful anti-immigrant laws that had been enacted in our country in recent years. My dissent was public and publicized and received media attention even here at home. When I came home, I came back to the church office to find that I had received a couple of very hateful phone messages. The messages struck me as cowardly, anonymous dissent, cloaked in disdain and disgust, and this made it easy for me to dismiss their content, but not before stewing a little while over the emotional impact of the messages. Even when receiving dissenting messages that we regard as incorrect and disrespectful, it still stirs up our feelings. In my experience, the emotional impact of being on the receiving end of dissent can be even more magnified when the dissenting voices are people we admire and respect. Consider, for an example, the best of a congregational meeting on a controversial subject. It can be difficult to hear that our friends and neighbors passionately disagree with us, passionately take a position different from our own. Being imperfect people as we are, sometimes our response to the internal emotional discomfort we feel when someone is expressing their dissent with us, one way that we deal with that sometimes is by looking for ways to call into validity the position of the dissenter. Have you ever done that? I have. It's a common response, one I'm not proud of. And not only because I think that such a response deprives us of an opportunity to learn, but also because I think such a response ultimately does not serve any of us well. For in truth, we need dissent. We need faithful and respectful opposition. If we will engage it, the discomfort created by dissent can push us to clarify our thinking. By critiquing our position, dissenters force us to confront the weaknesses in our own point of view. To respond well, we must either be more clear about where we stand and why, or we must refine our position in light of the critique, which often includes incorporating some of the dissenter's point of view into our own. Our country was created as a result of organized political dissent. Our religious tradition was created as a response result of impassioned theological dissent. Consider for a moment the title of a sermon by James Yates, who was the founder of the Scottish Unitarian Association. The sermon was called The Grounds of Unitarian Dissent, and it was delivered in 1812 at the opening of the chapel in Union Place, Glasgow. Yates felt it important that the very first sermon ever preached in that new church speak to the reasons of the Unitarian separation from the established church, as well as from all of the other dissenting churches that had emerged in recent years. As Unitarian Universalists, dissent is our heritage. It's also our practice. Take as just one little example Unitarian Universalists' leading role today in dissenting from the government's exclusive sanctioning of heterosexual marriages. Civil marriage is a civil right, we say, and we've been active in organizing across the country to make it so. Given this theological history and practice, we might be inclined to say that we are people who are more comfortable than the average person with dissent. But lest we congratulate ourselves too much, I want to lift up two potential risks that I think we need to guard against. One risk is the risk that we might be more comfortable expressing dissent to others than we are in having dissent expressed to us. That might be part of the reason why people with conservative political views and people who embrace Christianity as a central part of their spiritual path sometimes feel a little bit marginalized in Unitarian Universalist congregations, not just ours, but across the country. As a denomination, we tend to be made up largely of people with progressive political points of view, and Christianity is no longer the dominant spiritual expression among us. And yet, in every congregation, every Unitarian Universalist congregation in this country, there are Republicans and people with other conservative political points of view, as well as people for whom Christianity is central, life-giving, a part of their spiritual path. So this is a challenge for us, one challenge that I think we need to keep working on in our worship services and religious education classes and in casual conversation at coffee hour. We need to keep practicing welcoming and respecting dissenting points of view, lest we risk enshrining intolerance into our life together. So that's one risk that we might be more comfortable expressing dissent to others than we are in having dissent expressed to us. A second risk is the risk that we might be more comfortable with the idea of dissent than we are with the action dissent so often requires. Dissenting doesn't necessarily make an impact if it's only manifested as an idea we keep to ourselves or spoken amongst people who already agree with us. As the poet expresses so succinctly in his poem, no more is not a word, but an act. For dissent to be courageous, it has to be enacted. Dissent, enacted dissent, becomes courageous when it has consequences. The consequences might either be ones that we contend primarily with are ones that are borne by some others. For example, in the case of the struggle for civil marriage, I have met in my practice of ministry heterosexual couples who have come to me seeking a religious marriage and who have chosen not to obtain a civil marriage as an expression of their solidarity with gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender people who are not able to access civil marriages in every state in our country. That's one individual expression. Here's another example, this time collective. The ministers and lay leaders at the West Shore Unitarian Universalist Church outside of Cleveland decided this last year that they would establish a fee that they charge to all heterosexual couples who want their ministers to sign their marriage licenses. That fee is donated to Equality Ohio in order to assist with the pursuit of marriage equality in our own state. The fee is a representation of the church's opposition to discrimination against gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender people here in our state. The Reverend Galen Gingrich, senior minister of All Souls Unitarian Church in New York City and author of the lecture series on virtue that some of us studied earlier this fall, identifies courage in his catalog of virtues. Courage, he says, is the ability to see evil close at hand and take steps to confront it despite present danger. Courage is also the ability to see good afar off and take a step toward it despite the obvious risks. To know courage is to know a calling greater than fear. Dissent is courageous when it entails confronting that which is evil, that which would divide and diminish despite our fear of the consequences. Dissent is courageous when it includes moving, even if ever so slightly, toward the more just and whole future that we dream. Unitarian Universalism teaches us that we're responsible to something larger than ourselves. We call that something by a lot of different names here. Some of us call it humanity, some beloved community, some call it Gaia, others God. However we call it, we hold in common the principle that we are but a part of that something larger in which ultimately everyone is connected. Knowing that, affirming that, we are called to work for the common good, to work with faithfulness to that something larger. In its essence, our concept of salvation is not individualistic. It's collective. We're called to courageously dissent from the powers which privilege the few at the expense of the many. We're called to courageously dissent from policies which elevate the comfort of some above the survival of all. No more is not a word, says the poet, but an act. Another contemporary, Rosemary Bray McNatt, Unitarian Universalist minister serving in Brooklyn, New York. In her lecture titled Love and Power, the Universalist Dilemma, she writes about this risk that I'm trying to name today. She says, sometimes we conflate our dreams of the beloved community with the difficult and grueling work that might lead to its achievement. I'm afraid, she says, that we've embraced only the symbols of love and justice and peace with no commitment and often no clue what we will face at the moment we really attempt to make these things real. I'm afraid we have consistently underestimated the people and the systems we oppose and overestimated our own skill, our own willingness, and our own resilience. I'm afraid that we have settled for cheap grace in a very expensive world. Cheap grace. That phrase may be familiar to you. It's most often associated with Dietrich Bonhoeffer. Bonhoeffer was one of the leading theologians, teachers, pastors, and authors of the anti-Nazi confessing church in Germany. The consequences of his dissent from the evangelical church in Germany were swift and fierce. As a result of his stand, he was forbidden from lecturing at the University of Berlin, forbidden from publishing his work, and ultimately arrested for his infidelity. He was killed in one of Hitler's concentration camps, but his work survives. In one of his best-known works, The Cost of Discipleship, Bonhoeffer writes about what he calls cheap and costly grace. Cheap grace, he says, is the grace we bestow on ourselves. Cheap grace is the preaching of forgiveness without requiring repentance. Baptism without church discipline, communion without confession, cheap grace is grace without discipleship. By contrast, he continues, costly grace is the gospel which must be sought again and again, the gift which must be asked for, the door at which a person must keep on knocking. Our theology is different from Bonhoeffer's, but I believe the way in which he uses those phrases and the meaning that he ascribes to them resonates with us. When I talk about grace, I talk about grace as a gift of life, which we are freely given. Following Bonhoeffer and Bray McNatt, I would say that we settle for cheap grace when we are lulled by the lie that some people are more deserving of the gifts of life than others, and when we accept symbolic gestures instead of demanding substantive equality. When Bonhoeffer spoke of settling for symbol over substance, he meant settling for the symbols of baptism and communion, for example, without the substance of discipline and confession. Bray McNatt uses that same language, but she means settling for the symbols of love and justice and peace, without the commitment to work for the realization of love and justice and peace. The theology is different, but the meaning carries. We settle for cheap grace when we embrace symbols without substance, when we settle for surface changes that gloss inequality instead of working for meaningful transformation. Let's take as an example the terrible problem of poverty. As religious people, we know that we are called to help alleviate the suffering that people in poverty face. Along with those in other congregations, temples, and mosques all across our country, we do what we can to help alleviate the poverty and its consequences on the people who live in our midst. But if we were to stop there, if we were only to offer aid for the victims while refusing to learn about or speak out against the systems in our society that lead so many people to the experience of poverty, then maybe that would be fair to call that a kind of cheap grace. This doesn't mean that aiding the suffering is wrong. It's not. It's right. It's very right. And that's work that we're called to do. It's just to say that aid alone is not sufficient. Costly grace demands something more of us. It demands our descent from the political, social, economic systems that confer incredible wealth upon a very few and consign so many to bone-crushing poverty. Unitarian Universalism teaches us that our salvation is collective, and we are its agents. Remember that sermon that I mentioned earlier, the one from 1812 on the nature of Unitarian descent? I love it because it speaks so clearly to our tradition. The through line is absolutely clear. There are, in the style of sermons that day, 3 points in about 50 pages. The first point, is that we are called to use reason in our interpretation of Scripture and in our religious life. The first is a defense of reason. The second is an affirmation of the unity of God. And the third is an affirmation of our responsibility for our salvation here in this life on this earth. In his sermon, Yeats put it this way, and the words still speak to us. We regard holiness of heart and excellence of conduct as the only means of obtaining salvation in this life. He avowed that salvation beyond this life can only be granted by God, and that is left to God. But salvation in this life, that's our responsibility. In this life, he taught, Scripture teaches us through the example of Jesus how we are called to do God's work. Using our intellectual and moral faculties, he said, our calling is to endeavor to complete the work which God has begun. In our own language, we might say that our calling is to work for the creation of the beloved community in our midst. And though Yeats' argument wasn't clearly collectivist, I wanted it to be so. I was going to tell you that it was so, but then I had to go back and read the text as it is. And really, it's not. His argument was individualistic, and that was a flaw in the Unitarians' thinking, which is why we're so grateful that the Universalists came along and corrected them. The Universalists always had a collective understanding of salvation. But we know and we affirm now that we're dependent upon one another. We're dependent upon one another, and together we're all dependent upon this earth that we share. Wealth can buy a certain amount of immunity from suffering, but ultimately we share one fate and a common destiny. There's no escaping this. Either we will survive together or we'll perish together. Our calling is to work for our collective salvation. To do this, we must learn to courageously dissent from the forces of misery, death, and destruction in our own lifetimes. Now, I know that we all have responsibilities that keep us plenty busy, and most of us are so tired at the end of the day, we just want a little time for leisure and relaxation. And that's fine in moderation. Leisure and relaxation, we all need that to recharge our batteries. We have to care for ourselves. We just can't stop there. We have to care for one another too. And not only for our families, not only for the little circle of our friends, but for everyone. That doesn't mean that we have to do everything. It just means we have to find one way, one something we can do. Either we will survive together or we will perish together. So that's my message today. We don't have to do everything, but we have to find something to do that affirms life. This is an important part of how we keep ourselves and one another human, healthy, and whole. But there's more. There's a postscript. It's the really good news. There's joy in that work. There's joy in that work. There's joy in the process of being part of the resistance. Tell your neighbor, there's joy in being part of the resistance. Tell your neighbor. There's joy in being part of the resistance. There's joy in being resilient. Tell your neighbor, there's joy in being resilient. That's the really good news. There's joy in being resilient. There's joy in choosing life over death. It's not about just self-sacrifice. It's not just about hard work. It is about the spiritual experience of joy by knowing that we are contributing to our collective salvation. That's what I'm talking about. I'm talking about finding a way, even if it's just one little way, of committing ourselves again to a process of being part of our collective salvation, a way of saying no to the forces of death and destruction and yes to the beauty and wonder of life. Right now, there are a bunch of folks here in Northeast Ohio, including a handful from our congregation, who are working diligently against the practice of fracking. If you haven't heard, fracking is a controversial method of extracting natural gas from the shale formations deep underneath the surface of the earth. The dissenters are devoting tremendous amounts of their time and energy to educating, organizing, and speaking out about the potentially dire negative consequences this process of extraction can have upon our community. They're trying to enact legislation that would halt fracking here in Ohio. Theirs is hard and holy work. Hard because the gas companies have a lot of money and they stand to make a lot of money in this process, and they're formidable defenders of the process of fracking. Holy. Holy because they are being driven, the dissenters are being driven by a larger love, which motivates them to make personal sacrifices on behalf of the planet and her people. Whether or not they succeed, whether or not this particular iteration of individuals in their collective efforts succeeds in changing the laws here in Ohio, they are modeling for the rest of us a season of putting faith into action. Faith into action. Whether yours is faith in God or the evolving universe or people or life itself, you have some kind of faith. Your faith is what gets you up in the morning. It's where you place your trust and devote your life energy. Your faith is what enables you to make plans for the future and to keep on with those plans, even when it seems that there's no real justifiable reason for hope. Your faith, you have some kind of faith. So find a way to name it for yourself and then work for it. Defend it, sacrifice for it, speak out against the forces that threaten to destroy everything that you hold precious. This is how we keep ourselves healthy, human, and whole. This is how we work for our collective wholeness. May it be so, and amen.
Today we're having our monthly special collection to benefit this month, the Hartville Migrant Ministries, and this is a group that's served over 375 families in our area for about a decade now. They provide things like medical care, education, outreach, and transportation to the migrant community in Hartville. Our UUA association is conducting a special general assembly this June with a social justice theme in which they're going to focus on Arizona's anti-immigrant laws and attitudes. So it seems only fitting that we support our local migrant communities and their families at this time.
It is written in the Torah, I call heaven and earth to witness today that I have set before you life and death, blessings and curses. Choose life so that you and your descendants may live. Go in peace.